Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and her fabulous producers, Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. And as you've come to expect every single day between now and November of 2020, we played the powerful words of Colonel Vindman when he was testifying before the impeachment hearing in the fall of 2019. The world has fallen apart since then. He was telling his dad, it's all right. We know it's not all right. And now with Donald Trump as our leader during the time of a pandemic, oh my God, it's fraught with despair and fear. The words of Colonel Vindman, have them ringing in your ears.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
If it's Friday, it's Texas. And if it's Texas, it's the dean of the Austin Press Corps. It's the voice of Texas.
Right.
It's the editor of the Quorum Report.
Who else could it be?
Oh, my God. I think Scott Braddock. Exactly.
I do my own intro music these days. Now that we're doing this on Zoom, I feel very liberated to just be as silly as possible.
Well,
I might light up a cigar, and you don't know. You don't know what's in my coffee.
Oh, that's right. Texas
Tech. No idea what's,
I don't.
If people can't get enough of Scott Braddock, they need to know that they need to subscribe to the Texas Take podcast on iTunes. The next edition comes out on Saturday.
Okay, so tell me about Texas. Is it your personal iTunes or is it one that you do with a couple of other guys?
So I'm the host of the show, but we have journalists who are from throughout Texas, mainly do this with the Houston Chronicle. And it's,
that's great.
It's just informative. We try to keep people up to speed with what's happening. We've been doing it for years now, Arnie. I just have neglected to promote it on your show because I didn't want to take away from what you're doing.
No. Well, we're doing the Arneson take on Texas as opposed to the Texas take on Texas.
Well, people have come to expect the Arneson take on Texas. I think I might have mentioned to you that my publisher, who's from Bel Air, Texas, which is in Houston, you know, he's always back in Houston visiting family. But this is obviously before the COVID-19 outbreak. A couple of years ago, he was at the Embassy Suites near the Houston Galleria, and he was getting a drink at the bar downstairs. And this bartender started to talk about Texas politics, and my publisher says, oh, yes, I own this publication, the Quorum Report, and he was telling the bartender about it. And the bartender says, I know the Quorum Report. I listen KPFT every Friday morning, and Scott Braddock is on there talking Texas politics. So it all came full circle in Houston.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Every Friday morning in New Hampshire, I'm on a very conservative commercial station. I've been doing it for 20 years. Okay.
No
for
doubt they love you.
Well,
they have to love you.
Well, they
are
they,
you the Juan Williams of that show?
Yeah, I am.
Like on Fox News. I mean, and it's funny. It's funny. I was talking to my stepdad who lives in Arkansas, and he was – the thing about that audience, and I love my stepdad, he's a great guy, but he's pretty conservative in his politics. Yeah. And, you know, he says, you know, how much better would their ratings be if they would just fire that Juan Williams? And, you know, he's going off about how, you know, Juan Williams is a liberal and all this stuff. And I don't think he even realizes what they're doing, which is, you know, putting the guy on so that he can hate him and sort of be the lightning rod. It works.
What I love about it is that I get on at about 7 o'clock in the morning on Friday mornings. I've been doing it for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And sometimes phone lines are lit up before I even start talking. I was like,
can I take you on?
Exactly. Well, I want to take you on right now. Mm-hmm. So we're all hearing the president talking about getting us back to work. Yeah. The idea of this sheltering in place, it's gone too long, and that maybe, you know, maybe we can sort of weigh the cost-benefit analysis. And as I know, we're waiting to hear what Governor Abbott has to say. Mm-hmm. I saw a tweet, by the way, everyone, we are Zooming this on Thursday to air on Friday. And I saw a tweet, and it was about a group of people that were, you know, outside of the governor's mansion in Texas, basically saying, you know, we're important workers too. We need to go back to work, and basically sort of challenging the governor to basically end this shutdown. So I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking part of the problem with ending this shutdown is that most people are going to wait till August before they get a check, because the unemployment offices are just completely swamped. The amount of money that's being sent out for small business has already evaporated before they even got to the end of April. And I think part of the problem is that the government's response has been so either lethargic or not as full blossomed as it needed to be. Yeah. And that just has people even more frightened, because it isn't that they're afraid of the disease. They're also afraid of how do they survive?
How do they survive? There were some heartbreaking pictures out of Houston today, Cypress, Texas, right outside of Houston in Harris County. There was just a line of cars. It looked like going down the freeway on the feeder road, I guess. People waiting to get to the food bank there. We saw the same thing in Austin earlier this week. My friend Ken Herman at the Austin American Statesman was reporting from the Central Texas Food Bank, where they were just desperate to keep up with the demand. Same thing in San Antonio. Same thing all over the place. And small business owners are moving as quickly as they can because they want to keep people on payroll. So they had, you know, immediately put in for these loans so that they could keep paying their people. I know that there are certain businesses that are dipping into lines of credit right now to be able to maintain payroll. Let me tell you, Arnie, when you're having to pay people out of credit instead of cash, that's a bad situation for your business. At some point, people are not just underwater. They can't even see where the top of the water is. Right. For some of these folks, we have restaurants that operate on very small margins. You know, there's a lot of these great restaurants around Texas and elsewhere in the country that are not going to reopen if they close their doors today. There was just this week, some friends of mine were looking for a certain place to eat in Austin, a place that they enjoy that had been offering takeout until this week. They went on the website, and the website said, well, we're not open anymore. Feel free to peruse our menu, though. Thought being that maybe they'll be back, but maybe not. And there is this pressure to reopen an economy. Here's the issue. And I was thinking about this earlier in the week, and I put some stuff on social media. I go out of my way to not weigh in that much on President Trump. You might have noticed that. That's not my wheelhouse. It's not normally what I do. But I cannot imagine that Presidents Bush, and I'm starting with a Republican on purpose. I can't imagine Presidents Bush, Obama, Clinton, Bush 41 HW, any of them, Ronald Reagan, Carter, anyone blaming the governors for not having the resources that they need during a global pandemic, pointing the finger at local officials and at governors, pulling out of the World Health Organization at a moment when we need that kind of coordination more than ever. There is some legitimate criticism, I think, of the nation of China, not the people of China. Let's differentiate. We have the country, the government there, apparently covering this up, according to all reports, for at least 6 days, and not telling anybody, you know, about what was going on, when they knew there was, basically growing in a petri dish there, the makings of a worldwide pandemic, and they didn't do anything. But can you imagine any of those previous presidents not doing everything that it would take to reopen the economy in this situation, Arnie? We've had a contraction in the economy that is on par with what happened during the Great Depression. Boom, all of a sudden this happens in the matter of a few weeks. But we know what it would take to actually reopen the economy. Testing. People need to be tested. We need contract tracing. We need rapid testing so that people know who is A-okay to go to work and who needs to be protected. We have got to, and I think Governor Cuomo has talked about this very effectively, the idea that it's not a choice between the economy versus keeping people healthy and keeping them alive. The idea is, and the conversation should be centered around, testing as much as we can, ramping it all up with the full force and resources of the federal government, which, by the way, they passed a stimulus of $2 trillion. Where's the resources for testing? Why aren't we ramping that up? Every day it seems like we hear a new report about how there's a different kind of testing or maybe a different kind of testing site. We hear that all the time, but we don't hear anything about ramping up the capacity for testing. If we knew who was okay to go to work and who wasn't, then we'd be in a different situation, but we're not there at all. And you have places like Texas, which have seen our governor sort of dither for a while. If there is a better outcome in Texas, it will no doubt be because of local leadership in places like Dallas County, Harris County, where Houston is, Travis County, where I am in Austin, Bear County, where San Antonio is, where the county judges and the mayors move pretty quickly and swiftly to do things like shut down certain businesses, tell people to shelter in place, et cetera. And then we had a governor who sent mixed messages with a press conference, as we talked about before, a press conference where he talked about the idea that this is not a stay-at-home strategy when he unveiled his executive order on trying to protect Texans. And then the very next day, his office put out a public service announcement, a PSA video on YouTube that said, we want people to stay at home and they're required to stay at home. And no matter what's in the specific language, Arnie, the way the leadership talks about it matters, because people, the average Texans or people across the country, are not going to go read the executive orders of the governors and say, what am I allowed to do here? They're going to listen to what the leadership says.
So let me tell you why I'm pissed off. And the reason I'm pissed off is I've been staying home. I've been a good little doobie. I feel incredibly frustrated because I think of all the frontline workers that are being put in harm's way, and I can't help. My helping is not leaving the house. But here's where I'm furious. If all those people right now that are protesting outside the Capitol, the governor's mansion in Texas, or all the people that are protesting and wherever they're protesting all over the country, what I want them to protest about is that we don't have tests.
Right.
That's what they should be protesting. Not that, I mean, shutting down is not a heavy lift. What is the heavy lift is the test. And it's the test that will get us back, the test that will turn the economy on. It's, and we should be doing 20 million tests a day, right, a day, not a million a day, because a million a day would take us a whole year to get everyone tested just one damn time. Right. And people are going to need to be tested more than that if we have to wait until we have some kind of vaccination, if we have to figure out what kind of medication. So if I want to channel all that libertarian energy and all that I've got mind jack and I want to go back to work and where's my damn check, I want them to understand that all those things could be resolved if we could have quick testing, millions and millions of tests. Every time I hear Donald Trump talk about, oh, I've got millions of masks, when we need billions of masks, trillions of masks, he gives a big number that has no meaning given the amount that we need. So when he talks about testing more than any other country in the world, what he's testing is a joke. It's a joke. And I want to somehow go outside the governor's mansion in Texas and sort of have a come to Jesus moment with those people and say, don't you understand? You're going to get screwed twice. You're going to be pissed that you can't go to work. You're going to want to go to work. And then when you get sick, and there's no hospital system left, and all the nurses are ill, and there isn't enough equipment, and there aren't enough tests in the system, you will have not only no job, you may not have a life. And I mean this, a life.
Yeah, no life at all. This is from the pro-life crowd. The pro-life message needs to be test everyone. Rapid testing, get everybody tested. Test for the antibodies, test for the disease. I got to tell you, Arnie, this is a conversation that's very difficult. A lot of my friends in Houston and also in Dallas County, where they've been very aggressive about all this, the idea that sheltering in place and social distancing, staying at home, is something that is available to people who are pretty privileged.
Exactly.
Now, I run a business where we're basically all online. And my customers can purchase our subscriptions at quorumreport.com online. We never have, they don't have to come into a shop to do that. And we're, media all over the place has suffered, right? With layoffs, and you can see it. There's a list in the New York Times the other day about, layoffs and pay cuts and furloughs, et cetera, in the media business. But we're not like some of these other companies that rely on customers coming through the door and being able to talk to us and purchase things, et cetera. There are some folks right now who are really hurting, the kind of people in South Dallas County, which is predominantly African American. I was told some terrible stories this last week about the kind of people who don't live paycheck to paycheck. They live paycheck to almost paycheck. And they were having the back and forth with the county government about whether pawn shops ought to be allowed to be open Whether payday lenders ought to be allowed to be open. And you and I probably agree about, the nature of that business and how unseemly it can absolutely be. But those are the financial institutions for some people who are at the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder. And so I'm worried about them. I'm worried about all of these folks. And how do we get people back to work, Arnie? And here's the thing. When the governor and the president start to talk about, and if they lay out something that's only for public relations purposes, then it is shameful, because I can tell you
what
those people need to, and the governor's going to make his announcement on Friday. We'll let him do that and we'll analyze it, of course. But if it's just for window dressing, just for PR, that is so unhelpful to so many people who are just suffering right now, Arnie, and so many people who would tell you that it's not just a thing where they want to be selfish and go back and make their money.
Know,
and they've got
I
theirs,
know.
You know, because there are some
I
of
know,
those. There are absolutely some of those. Right. But there are also people right now who don't have anything, and they barely had anything before. And you know how it is with a lot of these folks. They don't need some big handout. What do they need? They need a hand up. And what the government could do right now to give them that hand up is to fortify our system against this virus. And right back to the main point, testing is the key.
I have lost so much income. I have no Airbnb anymore. I'm losing all my students because there's no school. So, and that's how I pay for this house. Okay. And so the reason I want testing is that I've had people say, I want to come live with you. I am terrified of saying yes, because this is a silent killer. It is, people don't necessarily have to show symptoms. The reason I want tests is so that I can financially survive too, Scott. So it has touched me financially and personally. It's touched me because I'm beginning to, but I'm frustrated because I want to channel all that anger at not going back to work into understanding that the real anger is, if we could test and do it all the time, then guess what? We would then be able to know who could enter the workplace and who could not, who had immunities and who did not. But we know nothing. And that knowing nothing is going to destroy the economy over and over again. If we keep going back to work and then everybody gets sick again, go back to work and then everyone gets sick again, that will destroy the economy even deeper than it is now.
Yeah, I can tell you that in Texas, we don't have the level of testing they've had in these other places. I can say with some confidence that we have not had an overburdened hospital system just yet. In Dallas County and in Harris County, it seems like we're doing okay. Same thing in Travis County and Bexar County, as I'm just giving you the bigger counties right now. Doesn't look like they're over-hospitalized in or that the system's overburdened down in the valley either. But I take it right back to the point about the local leaders really stepping up in these situations. The very first big decision in Texas, and one of the first big decisions in the country about all of this, was to shut down one of the biggest, if not the biggest, international event, which is South by Southwest here in Travis County in Austin.
That was shocking.
If they hadn't done that, I mean, now in hindsight, and people at the time were very angry, although it was business and government moving together on that. The big companies, the big tech companies like Facebook and Google and TikTok, et cetera, the big spenders had already pulled out of the event and they weren't going to be there for South by Southwest. Then Austin, the city of Austin and Travis County moved to shut it down officially and say, okay, nobody's going to come in for this. If they had not done that,
oh my God,
would this be a hotspot in the same way that New York and New Orleans have become now?
Yep.
Not sure, but and here's the thing: when you do social distancing properly, the reward is nothing happens, right? So it's hard to go back and say
exactly.
People are angry because their big event didn't happen, but also a lot of people who might have gotten sick didn't get sick, and so now here in Austin they're taking another pretty proactive measure for the major cities in Texas, which is Austin's the first to require that if you go out in public, you have to have a face covering.
Yeah.
And I just saw, I think it was today or yesterday, it's all running together on me now, Arnie, but Dallas County, they're doing the same thing now, requiring some cloth covering if you're going to go out.
Right. This is a hydra. It has so many heads and every head has a different consequence. And the problem is we have no leadership who's able to sort of pull together all those heads and figure out how to respond. And that's what I think is just so tragic. But I want to talk a little bit about how important Texas is. President Trump's Economic Revival Task Force is loaded with Texans. And I'm reading this from the Dallas Morning News. And It's got Ted Cruz. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's got Cornyn. It's mm-hmm. got everybody. So explain to me, what's that about? Why is it so Texas, not Texas focused, but Texas heavy?
Well, we've got a lot of folks from Texas. Also, Kevin Brady, who's yeah. a former Ways and Means chairman. By the way, over my desk here, Arnie, there's a commendation from Kevin Brady from 2008 for a congressional commendation, Scott Braddock, for his service and professionalism in the field of political journalism. That was 2008 was back when it was okay for Republicans to praise a member of the press corps. Okay. But I do think that you have some and I say that to say this.
I know.
That Brady has been a good friend and I think is a pretty even-handed guy. You know, there are people who know how to put folks back to work who are on this panel that the president has put together. Yeah. But all of this is just planning, right? Until the president and the various governors around the state, and of course there was the nonsense back and forth about the governor, the governors not being able to override the president and vice versa earlier in the week, with the president claiming that he had total control, total authority, which is nonsense.
He's the czar. He's the czar. He's not a president. He's a czar.
He's the one who can, you know, he has his authority is total and all of that.
Yeah.
Look, I think we've got some really brilliant minds on this deal. And of course, some of it is partisan. There's partisan structure to this. You see a lot of Republicans. But you also see construction executives who are on this deal, as well as the CEOs of some of the oil and gas companies. And oil and gas, of course, reeling as well pre-coronavirus and now during the coronavirus pandemic.
Yep. Well, you know, what I think is also interesting about this task force, I mean, like the Angus King, the independent senator from Maine is on it. There's a very powerful Democrat. I'm not sure. I can't remember who it is. It's one of the top Democrats is on it. So part of it is that even though he wants to act like the despot and he wants to be the czar and say he's got total control and it's really up to him, he's actually a coward and he wants to be able to blame someone else. So one of the reasons why he's got such an interesting mix of people is that in a way it gives him cover, because it was all Republicans and all yes men, then guess what? It would not serve him well, because he likes to sort of change his position every 14 minutes, and he can kind of sort of blame them, because there's enough people, I think, that are thoughtful on this group that have been pulled together that may either resist going back to work or they might file a minority report. Do you know what I mean? So it'll be very interesting to see how they operate together.
Yeah. And, you know, I saw it was interesting, some commentary from, I think it was Ian Bremmer over at the Eurasia Group, who was talking about how in some of these other countries, they have moved really quickly toward basically, you know, what you meant, the people who are moving toward being a despot and authoritarianism breaking out all over the place. And President Trump, in some ways, really not doing that. You know, his back and forth with the governors kind of puts that on display, the fact that we still have a system of federalism, and the states are the ones that are making these decisions. He can put political pressure on them, of course. And, you know, if you have the president and certain Republican governors saying one thing, Democratic governors saying another thing, people are going to splinter into their normal, you know, partisan arguments. But I do think that the fact that, for example, the president hasn't centralized testing from the federal government. That's something that a dictator would want to do. That's the kind of thing that you can take advantage of if you're moving in a dictatorial kind of way. What I was arguing for, by the way, was not that, but instead the feds coming up with the resources for the states to be able to do that testing, which they do need to be able to do. But yeah, it's hard for a person who doesn't ever want to accept any responsibility for anything to be a dictator.
Well, and that's, in a way, that's our safe harbor. It sounds awful, but that is our safe harbor. So he likes to act like the despot, but he doesn't like to pull the trigger of the despot. And that's what's so fascinating, which is why he's constantly blaming governors for something that he really was responsible for doing, because he wants to sort of somehow deflect any responsibility away from him. But by deflecting responsibility away from him, he also doesn't take responsibility.
Yeah, we have seen this rise of so-called strongman leaders all across the West, right? Not just in the United States. We've seen it in Europe and in, down in South America as well, in different places. Maybe fortunately for us, we don't have the strongman. We just have the one who plays one on TV.
Exactly right. All right, really quickly, before I only have like a minute left. What's happening with voting in Texas? That's a huge issue. And I know that you mentioned that there are some issues that it went to court.
Yeah, this is going to be critical, and we've got full coverage at quorumreport.com of this. Arguments earlier in the week, the Texas Democratic Party is asking to expand vote by mail for people who fear that they might get sick if they go to a polling place. A Travis County judge agreed with them and is issuing an order that says that vote by mail will be expanded. But of course, that's going to be appealed by the state, and I would note with some irony that the courts right now in Texas are meeting via Zoom because the judges and attorneys think that they might be at risk of infection while they argue about whether voters would be at risk of infection by going to polling places.
Well, I think that's what we should do. We should just like take pictures of their Zoom meeting and say, if you can't meet, how can I vote? And on that note, Scott Fredrick, I love you. He is the voice of Texas, the editor of the Quorum Report. Every Friday, it's Scott. And when we come back, it'll be Current Cast. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Arnie.
Yeah.
Are you rain ready on this Current Cast? Many people in the Great Lakes region have experienced the misfortune of finding water in the basement during heavy rain. Now a free online tool called My Rain Ready can help homeowners assess and address their flood risk. Marcella Bondi Keenan of the Chicago-based Center for Neighborhood Technology says users answer questions about their home and landscaping. The tool estimates their flood risk and provides custom recommendations.
So things as simple as making sure their gutters are clear and making sure that the street sewer grates are cleared.
Or more advanced actions, such as replacing a concrete patio with a garden that will absorb stormwater and help make a home more rain-ready. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Bell goes ring, books remove, student goes think, and teacher goes prove. Spicer goes test, together we can succeed at everything. Use their skills, get better grades, and the parent goes wow, wow, wow. But there's one goal that we all have. What does the test say? What the test say?
Pass, 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 pass.
What the test say?
Bubble, 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 bow. Bubble, 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 bow. Bubble, 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 bow.
What the test say?
Proof, 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 proof.
What the test say?
Slept all night, woke refreshed. Breakfast gone, down the hatch. Studied hard, homework done. Now's the time to ace this one. Focus in and take my time. Add, subtract, and multiply. But if a snack is what I need, reaching in my desk for G-E-E-E-Sits, G-E-E-E-Sits. Time to pass this test with E-E-E-E-E's.
What does the test say?
Get your number two pencils out. Your number two pencils out. Get your number two pencils out.
What the test say?
Reading, science, math, essay. Reading, science, math, essay. Reading, science, math, essay.
What the test say?
Dream, believe, achieve. Dream, believe, achieve. Dream, believe, achieve.
What the test say? What does the test say?
Welcome. Welcome to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We love joining Bill Curry because he's so thoughtful, because he's been a former politician, which makes me really love him, because me too. And he was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He has written for Salon.com. He's a great thinker. And we're living in challenging times. And during challenging times, we need to think out loud so that we can begin to process what we're experiencing, how to deal with it, and how to dream about going forward. So if I can imagine anybody I'd want to dream with, it's Bill Curry. Welcome to the program, Bill. You're welcome. So yes. It's been an interesting week. The president is now told us that he is in total control of everything, and he's actually a despot and a king and a czar. And then at the same time, he doesn't really...
That was a relief.
And yet, at the same time, he doesn't want to own any responsibility for any decision-making. So that's also an interesting phenomenon.
It's his career. Trump, the only thing Trump ever succeeded at was branding.
Yeah.
And so he brands other people's work. He puts his name on other people's works and let the governors take all the risks and all the responsibility. And all his entire thought process, you can be sure, is simply that when we do announce the reintroduction of our reentry into a more normal stream of commerce, it'll be a really happy moment. And so I'll want to be associated with it.
Right.
And that's all this is about. It's nothing but his ability to brand the work of others, which is how he makes his living.
Well, guess what? I'm ecstatic because it won't happen till 2021 and he'll be au revoir.
Well.
So maybe. All right. So it's been an interesting week because he's put together this task force to look about how we get back to work. All the governors are telling him, we make this decision without you because every situation is different. Every mayor says the same thing. We're all waiting for the millions of tests that we should be having every day, but we don't have. And yet at the same time, this was also a week for the Democrats. And it was a week for the Democrats because it was a trifecta. It was Bernie, Obama, and Warren. And they all came out and they all put their hands on Joe Biden. Now, we were expecting Barack Obama to do this. We were kind of waiting for him to do this. What was interesting was how full-throated Bernie was in his endorsement. And Elizabeth was Elizabeth. I mean, she wasn't ecstatic, but at the same time, she basically said he's a good man. And what you kind of got from the sort of the bookends of Bernie and Warren is that they also kind of implied, we're pretty sure that he's going to listen to us. And so it's been a very, very interesting week for Democratic politics. The question is, how does Biden use this trifecta to his advantage? And does he have the skill set to do that?
I think, first of all, there are some skills that he clearly lacks, but I think he does have the skill set to do this, which is the part about making enough policy concessions to bring a party together.
Okay.
And I think he is the very aspect of Biden that makes me worry when he talks about getting bipartisan with the Republicans, as if he hadn't lived through his own previous administration or absorbed any of its lessons. But that same aspect, that same quality, makes me think that he will want even more to bring his own party together. And the likely circumstances of a Biden presidency will be that he'll be so dependent on his party. We have a chance that's really, the other thing that's emerged this week, I think, is the growing chance of Democrats to take the Senate, which gives us the chance to do so much. But it will be just as with Clinton and with Obama, none of the great accomplishments will come with a single Republican vote.
Yeah.
So the president's dependence on this base, this will be a moment for the Democratic Party to get bipartisan with itself.
That's what I was going to say. Okay. Oh, my God, I love you.
So that's the process that's already begun. Let me just point out one thing, Arnie, before I give it up here. And that is, it's already the opposite of what Hillary Clinton did. And I've touched on this in different ways before, but nothing has annoyed me more in the last 4 years than Hillary's continuous blaming of Bernie. Not Comey, not Putin, not misogyny, not the Electoral College, and certainly not herself. Hillary takes zero responsibility for failing to bring her party together. And when in fact, it was not Bernie's treatment of her, which was civil from the start. It was one of the least vitriolic challenges I've ever seen. The line of Bernie's we remember most is nobody
did emails. Emails. Exactly.
And it was the Clintons always going after the Bernie bros and the working class and all that. Just, you know, that was what the real tone of that campaign was. And it was her job, as it is the job of every victor in every primary since I've been alive, to bring the party together after the primary. And she did none of it. She fought the Bernie people on the platform. And then when they had to give a few concessions at 11 o'clock at night, at the exact 11th hour, literally, the Bernie crowd got some important things in the platform. And then she never mentioned the platform again or put any of it in her speeches. Trump stole both political reform and economic inequality from the Democratic Party in the form of the Drain the Swamp ads. Hillary was silent. She got cheated in a lot of ways in the general election. But if she had taken more of the parties of the progressive message and run on it in that election rather than Trump didn't even steal it from her. She gifted him. She gave him our heritage.
Okay? She did. She did.
You know, she gifted him economic populism and political reform. Great, great campaign, madam. And so the first thing about this, I'm just ranting now.
First
thing about this week, Arnie, is that Biden already, he'd started saying healthcare is a right, not a privilege. Just to resonate Bernie's line. He's given on a lot, he's mentioned policy concessions that he's volunteering to make. The real rift in this party, unlike for the country has enormous rifts based on race, gender, age, location, urban versus rural. The Democratic Party doesn't. Telling me somebody's race, age, location, gender, it doesn't tell me that much about whether they're pro-choice or not, or whether they're where they are on any one of our, from cultural issues to economic issues. We are not, as a party, divided that way. Our division is over the fundamental questions of the distribution of wealth, income, power, and opportunity at the heart of populism, and of the political reform at the heart of progressivism. And that's what the Bernie and Warren bases have been most attached to. And that's where the division is. And Biden has been reaching out in a way, already has done more than Hillary did in her entire campaign to reach out. How far will it go? How do we make it real policy? You know, and when he gets elected, those are all huge questions. But so far, he's avoiding her worst mistake. He is not treating his own base like dirt. He's doing it with respect. It's the smart thing to do. I'll never understand why she didn't, but to me, it's the lead. To me, it's the biggest story of the last 10 days.
No, you're there's a humbleness to Biden that is clearly been evident. You have said this over and over again that he tends to lead from behind. He becomes the environment in which he's in, and you know when he was talking about going, you know, working with Republicans.
Yeah,
thinking was no, you mean new Democrats. Those are the Republicans that you used to work with, because the modern Republican has died. It does not exist anymore. We became a party of the progressives and the moderate Republicans, but we still call ourselves Democrats. So when he was talking about reaching across the aisle, people were thinking Republicans, and I'm thinking, no, he's able to deal with the progressives because he's from that sort of more moderate Republican, new Democratic wing, but he wants to work with progressives because he wants to fix it. He wants to solve things. He wants to find solutions. So in an interesting way, and you even heard that from Barack. Barack kept saying he is the most progressive candidate we ever had. If I was running today, I wouldn't run the way I ran in 2008. And the one thing, we had John Nichols on this week. It was an incredible interview. It was the day that Barack endorsed Joe. But I pulled out Barack's comments about Bernie Sanders. And one of the things that I was so blown away by that John Nichols said, and I want to sort of share it with you because I think it needs to be repeated over and over again. We talk about, oh my God, look what is possible. Look what is doable now. We could take over the Senate. The Democrats are really more coming together and finding cohesion on so many of the important issues. And he corrected me. And he said, no, Arnie, it's not that it's doable. It is necessary. Yeah. We cannot imagine them. We must do them if we are to save ourselves, if we are to save our democracy, and frankly, if we're to save the planet. That is how urgent these issues are. And what is hopeful about Joe is that I think that there are enough people around him who get that. I mean, he's even meeting with AOC. I mean, it's kind of interesting to sort of see who he's talking to. Maybe he's doing this now to soften us up before the November election. But you know what? No, that's exactly right.
Yeah, because, that's right. Go exactly. ahead. Soften me up. I love feeling soft.
I know. You're hilarious.
And it's also one of the things for progressives in this next few months. There's a piece, and many of the strong Sanders supporters feel this way. Their contempt, the establishment has contempt from them for them, which is almost matched by their contempt for the establishment. And their insistence on a kind of old style, you get this by fighting every step of the way, by pressing, you never credit your op. This is a contest of wills. Frederick Douglass, the power won't be given to us. We're going to have to fight. We're going to have to take it. I get all that, and it's right. But with it, when you're getting bipartisan with your own party, there's also something to be said for earning goodwill.
Yes.
For knowing when the moment for the fight comes, for testing out how much really will be done based upon the actual conversion of your previous foe, you know?
Right.
And so our number one job is not to continue, in my view, it's not to continue to pressure Biden, especially not publicly on the platform, to get a strong, the platform's already looking pretty good to me. Mm-hmm. And we should continue to press, you know, for what we need. And they're aware of the importance of it, but to be building for the fight next January.
Exactly.
And what are the things we should be doing now to get ready for when the real, for our next struggle? Our struggle now truly is simply to be on board and fight as hard as we can and get rid of Trump and get a Democratic Senate. We then, if we do that, we then resume the campaign of pressure. And you know, those aren't exactly a dichotomous, you know, eras that you know, but pretty much that should be the rule.
Well, and you know, and in a way, this horrific pandemic is also again another opportunity, because it has really pulled the scab off, and everything that we have known has not been invested in, has not been repaired, has been exposed because of the grotesque inequality. All those things are now just becoming so raw and so obvious that in a lot of ways, it gives us an opportunity that we've never really had before. You see, if Hillary Clinton were president, someone said, oh, none of these things would happen. I said, no, we'd still have the pandemic. And maybe we would have glossed over or covered up or been a little more effective at leadership, but it wouldn't have really sort of shown us the way Donald Trump has helped to show us how flawed the system is. And this system demands change. And I think to a large extent that gives Joe Biden cover. It gives him cover to do a lot of these progressive things, because only things that solve it are not, you know, the Wall Street can't fix this. Wall Street doesn't make, you know, testing. You know, only a strong public health system and scientists, and those are the people that will be able to get us through and find the tests and do whatever. And I just think that in a way, what we squandered with 9/11 because it was Bush is now an opportunity to repair things because we've come to such an edge.
I agree 100%. And I would add that there is the lesson of the pandemic and all that it has exposed. And then there is also the atmosphere, the environment into which we will emerge after the pandemic. I was doing another interview yesterday and someone said to me, well, how can you be doing universal health care when you have all the debt run up by the Trump tax cuts and now all the debt run up by the anti-recessionary stimulus being done now? Where will you ever find the money for healthcare? And I said, the only reason you think universal healthcare costs more is that you've been confused by our unfortunate political debate. But the rest of the world pays half per capita what we do.
Exactly.
Running out of money will make universal healthcare an absolute necessity.
There you go.
The only way, just as a real, what they call a robust public option can bring down costs, that could be the first, you've heard me say before, if it's a public option that stops subsidizing for-profit insurance companies and that brings all the uninsured into the system now so that we start by A, saving money, and B, reaching everyone. Well, if it takes a few extra years to move the employer-based part back in, which the country is really ripe for now, by the way, that'll be okay. But there's nothing short of that that can save the kind of money we're going to need to save. It's going to be a great time in which for all progressives to be reconsidering. Too often, we're just Hubert Humphrey Democrats, with all love and respect to Hubert Humphrey, but ready to start a new government program to minister to the victims of this system after the fact, mm-hmm. rather than to take a walk up that river and see where all the victims are coming from and change the rules and change the system. The pressure on us, as well as the political impetus for it, the pandemic has given us the impetus, and the austerity that will follow it, the great need that will follow it, should get us, whether it's climate change or healthcare. We're going to have to make this a better system.
Exactly, and
a less expensive and less redundant system. And that's the only way to do it.
But they've actually also begun to give the roadmap. One of the things we know is, assuming you can finally get your unemployment check, because every state is imploding. I mean, they can't handle the onslaught. But what I think is so ironic is, what did Republicans and Democrats agree to? Adding $600 a week to every unemployment. That is evidence that they know people have been paid SHIT. They know that the minimum wage or the living wage, whatever the way, they knew that that would not sustain them. And in a way, it was an acknowledgement of that by adding the $600 per week. Some people don't even make $600 per week, you know? And so the irony of adding it only proves why we need to sort of address the idea of that livable wage. And that livable wage now is more obvious as to why it's needed than ever before.
Yeah, no question about it. And the country, I've said two things. The Democrats are closer together. When the Democratic Party did the New Deal and the Great Society, it was a party that was divided between Northern liberals and Southern segregationists. And it still managed to produce those two extraordinary times. The party is more united, and it's also has more of the country behind it. The country wants this. Yeah. The whole country wants it. When Obama was first president and he offloaded his promise to raise the minimum wage when we had both houses, one of his explanations was that he didn't want to spend political capital on it. And of course, it was ridiculous. The Republicans lived in fear that he would propose it, because by enacting a raise in the minimum wage, he would gain political capital. People would be grateful. People would be more supportive of him. And the economy would heal faster, making him look like a more competent manager of that. It just, all those kinds of mistakes aren't going to be made.
Yeah.
Just for the point you're making, this situation has clarified and will continue to clarify a set of injustices and a set of inefficiencies that have to be cured. Yeah. And it won't do it for the third of the country that's Trump.
Right.
But, you know, they can go off and if we win the Senate as well as the White House, if we do those two things in November and we pass a lot of this program, the Republican Party, as we know it, will have to be transformed.
Exactly.
In order to compete.
So I want to talk about voting before I let you go, because all this also sort of looks to what's going to happen in November. How do we exercise the franchise? What will the courts allow? I mean, I'll give you an example. I just learned this today about New Hampshire. So there's money that the feds have put out that could help cities and towns deal with their elections. And there's apparently $250 million that's earmarked for New Hampshire. Do you know why we haven't accessed a dime of it? Because we have to come up with $600,000 in order to access the $250 million. And our Republican governor does not want to access the $600,000 because he doesn't want to take that money and invest it in some kind of like adequate response in anticipation of a November election. So someone said something very curious, because I've always heard, oh no, we can't do it online. So listen to what someone said. He said, I just filed my tax returns with the federal government online. If I can file my tax returns online with complete confidence that they will be protected and privileged, why can't I vote online? And I don't know what the answer to that is, but it made me think, I gotta think that one through. I mean, there are so many naysayers about every aspect of how we exercise the franchise. I'm not sure we've played them all out, But here's an example of a state that has $250 million on the table, and we can't grab a dime of it because we're not willing to come up with the $600,000. How delightful. He's saving us money, is the argument. And I'm going, oh, great. And at what expense?
Well, that's the price of having a Republican governor. In these times. You know, one of the things I was following the thought process, the public thought process of Nancy Pelosi on voting online by the Congress. You know, we should all be able to vote by mail, and we should be able to vote online. I was thinking to myself, not only will it enable them to meet now, not only should they be able to do that in a crisis, but it would be great to see if they did that permanently, which would make all each member of Congress so much harder for the lobbyists to track down.
That's right, that op-ed.
Lobbyists would have to go all over the country to each district knocking on doors. And, you know, I don't see the downside. The problem with these people is they should never have been allowed. The people who call for bipartisanship and ignore that all the great bipartisan initiatives of the last 25 years have been colossal failures. Really, we should have been trying to keep these people apart. They should never be allowed in a room without adult supervision. And so, you know, yeah.
You're hilarious.
Let's just have them all vote from home forever.
So let me just say something. Oh, you're hilarious. So what I'm thinking is, I mean, what people don't get is that, first of all, you know, a lot of these people have been in Washington in perpetuity. I mean, we don't have term limits. They've massaged the lobbyists. The lobbyists have massaged them. They have war chests. So nobody can ever even imagine replacing them. And part of that problem is that what is home is not the district, but inside the Beltway. That is now their home. And that was not supposed to be their home. That was supposed to be a temporary condition. And then they were supposed to return home and actually spend more time at home than in Washington. And what I think would happen if we could Zoom meetings and if we could do that is that they would be actually more sensitive to their constituents. I mean, the example of AOC is a perfect example of what happens when you spend too much time in Washington. And that is, here's a powerful Democrat that loses. By whom? By some youngster. I mean, that's really what AOC was, right? Who galvanized people, who talked to people in the district, who was actually at home, a place he had really sort of shown up in. And this is what happens. In a lot of ways, it'll make them more responsive. It'll make them more relevant. And it will also, I think your point is really well taken. It will mean that the lobbyists will either have to multiply their numbers by millions in order to sort of massage every congressperson in their district. But more importantly, it might mean that finally we get representation that isn't controlled because the lobbyists write the bill, they write the check, and then they tell them what to do.
And again, the money will still be a huge problem, but truly the logistics of it would actually be different. Hey, it just reminds me that, you know, the two big positive developments this week, one were that Biden demonstrated to me that he's not going to repeat Hillary's mortal mistake of mistreating her own base and ignoring the progressive message in her election. That's why she lost. If she hadn't done that, they wouldn't have been able to steal it from her. And the second great piece of news, though, to me, is that there are clearly in the last 10 days, three or four Senate races have been added to that list of races we can win. The Loeffler race is now a real race in Georgia for sure.
Well, she shot herself.
All show that the Tom Tillis race is a real possible pickup.
Right.
Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell are not out of the woods. And Steve Bullock is tied or a point ahead in Montana. Those are all races that weren't really on anybody's radar. We only had four races really, and we had to win all of them to get to 50. And now I count nine.
Wow.
That we have to win, and Doug Jones is the plus or minus in Democrat in Alabama. So all I can say to everyone listening in New Hampshire, in your base there, is get thee to Maine. and get rid of that dissembling, clever, however, you know, however cleverly is Susan Collins.
Her numbers are tanking.
Just make sure she's gone, because it all starts I can't say that it all starts in New Hampshire in this general election. Although I guess you have a Senate race.
Well, we have Sheen. We don't have a Senate race. I mean, they can't even find a candidate to run against.
Okay, good. So then,
I mean, they have someone.
Nothing against her, but if as long as that looks okay, get everybody over to Maine and get rid of Sue Collins. She's just really, well, and we'll all feel better if Collins is gone.
Well, she's like a dish rag. You know, I mean, there's nothing there. There's no spine. There's no conviction. There's no position. And it's like, I mean, she is a disappointment. That is all she is the disappointment.
The main thing is to get a government that begins to work, move in the right direction in a time of crisis. But Collins also has the distinction of at least once or twice a year pretending to be listening, pretending to be ready to make some kind of meaningful compromise. And then, like, you know, Lucy and Charlie Brown in the football, she always takes it back. So just the amount of time we have to spend being annoyed by her, just to save the emotional stress in my time in those days, for God's sake, get rid of her.
Here we go. Annoyance relief. Bill Curry, we knew we called you right. This is The Attitude with Artie Artisan, Stephanie Collins, and Dave Scott. Thank you so much, Mr. Curry.
Talk to you soon.
What a great way to end the
Everybody
week.
Be safe.
Yeah, you too. Ciao. Bye-bye. Change.